You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Hello, you beautiful people. Table Talk is a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer and a broadcaster, and I'm a gastronaut. Now, across the past year, our world has seemed to grow smaller and more complicated. Whether it's the climate crisis or COVID or the issue of simply feeding the growing population, there's been a coming together, a renewed focus on shared global challenges. In the food world, many are looking towards technology to bring radical and inspiring solutions. Now, I love a bit of tech. It's been a joy to watch agritech and food tech around the world really flourish even during the pandemic. So today we're going to discuss the global agritech scene, in particular from the venture capital point of view. We'll be looking for the innovations and big ideas, the places where they're coming from. We'll learn a few secrets and we'll hear about some solutions which are all set to be deployed against the huge challenges we're all facing. And I'm joined by a ridiculously tech-savvy supergroup. We have Christian Guber, associate at Atlantic Food Labs. Hello there, Christian.
Hi there.
We've got Ivan Fanetti, co-founder of Five Seasons Ventures. Hello, Ivan.
Buongiorno.
And Nadav Berger, founder and managing director at Peakbridge VC. Hello there, Nadav.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
Well, welcome to all of you, and thank you so much for joining us. Now, let's start with a few broad questions, really. It seems that innovation and technology is more important in the agri-food sector than ever before, with all the challenges that the world's facing. Is that how you see things, Christian? Is now a particular peak for this area of the industry?
Yeah, I think you could definitely say so. I think the food industry, as many other industries also, when you look where venture capital actually flows in, was for a long time pretty much dominated by more startups on the B2C side of things. You had many food delivery startups, marketplaces, also some CPG companies. But as problems get more difficult and we're seeing more progress in other more related areas, for example, in biotech or machine learning, this, of course, also fuels a technological advantage that we see here. So, I mean, of course, this despite Corona reviving many delivery models, I think we are also pretty much excited about the tech side of things here, really more at the beginning of the value chain then.
Mm-hmm. And Ivan, would you agree? Is this a particularly exciting time right now?
I think the last 5 or 6 years have been really a pivotal moment for anybody in the agri and food tech world. I think, you know, 5, 6 years ago, it was impossible or very, very hard for founders to find capital. There were maybe 2 or 3 specialized investors. Our businesses, the three of us, didn't exist. And most of the innovation was still pretty much done within the boundaries or the basements of the large food and agri-tech companies. I think the last 5 years have seen a sudden change, really linked to consumers paying more attention to what food they consume, where it comes from, the nutritional elements of it, the sustainability aspect of it. I think the internet has exposed a lot of the hidden secrets, you know, lots of Netflix specials, which are, you know, fairly well done. And they really make difficult topics accessible and digestible by mass market. So consumers have moved a lot. The pace of innovation, given the cost of technologies, I think you talked about, you know, artificial intelligence and robotics, the cost of technology has dropped in the last 10 years. And even sectors like food and ag can afford it now. So consumers are pulling for it. The technology cost is reducing. And our humble role, which is the provider of capital between entrepreneurs and needs, figured out a way to tell the story about the benefits and sustainability and the need for specialized capital. So we kind of closed the loop within the space of 5 years. And now this is a flourishing moment for all the parties involved, I think.
Mm. And Nadav, would you say that there are just more projects being started? There are more ideas coming on, or are there better and more innovative ideas?
Actually, I think it's both. And I couldn't agree more. And building on what my dear friend Ivan just said, and I come from the food industry. I'm third generation food industry family, so have some perspective. And the way we look at it, or maybe I can describe it in a very simple way, again, linked to what Ivan said, is that we look at the food industry in general. And remember, it's the largest industry on earth, exhausting planet, feeding people every day. And we look at it as an industry which moved from a push to a pull, meaning the brands used to push us. And normally they would have, you know, they pushed us stuff that were, let's say, more economical for them. So buy this or consume that. And with open resources, the data, the Netflixes of the world, people are more aware and they consume in a smarter way. So they ask questions and they ask where my food is coming from and how can I consume it and is it good for me? And I think that COVID brought this to the front page. And direct, if you look at the three main chronic diseases or the factors of death issues in the world, it's diabetes, cancer, and cardiovascular issues. They all come from food at the end of the day. So the awareness is there, and the consumers are now pulling rather than being pushed by the brands, which is very exciting.
Yeah. Christian, let's just step back for one second and assume that some of the people listening to this don't really know what we're talking about. So can you give us some examples of agritech? If you were down a pub and you were talking to a primary school teacher about agritech, and they're saying, what is that? Is that a robot in a field picking a plum? How would you describe it? What are the key elements of agritech that are most visible?
Agritech, currently, the way we see it, it's all about making the existing farming technologies much more efficient, using technologies that we've seen already applied in many other fields with many sensors, analytics. You can use satellite images, drone images. And then these applications, I feel like it's already like kind of like a joke because it's always precision XYZ. You have precision agriculture, precision farming, and you have precision fermentation. So I think that gives you an idea of what we're talking about. It's really about increasing efficiency, reducing food waste. So I think for me, one of the many startups we see, they apply machine learning technology to get a better grasp of the farms and the images there. Robotics is another area, as you have mentioned, but it's really about giving, I think, the farmers the tools of the 21st century. So this is about making the current farming more efficient, mainly, and more resourceful. I think the other side of the medal here, which is maybe more disruptive, is of course everything related to cellular agriculture. So that is, instead of improving the existing state, it's working on something completely new, which is currently inherently much more expensive and doesn't enable growing cultured meat, for example, at scale yet. But I think it's also something that has to be taken in the picture here.
Excellent. Okay. And Ivan, back to you. Now, you were talking in terms of 5 or 6 years as being a sort of a turning point for this area. Do you think we can yet speak in terms of trends? You know, that's 5 or 6 years is a pretty short amount of time in terms of technology development. But are there trends that you can spot already and areas that are particularly exciting and areas where there's a huge amount of potential that's not being tapped?
There is a lot being written over the last few years in terms of trends. We publish every year State of European Food Tech Research that analyzes, you know, those trends. And I think there was a first wave of innovation in food, on the food supply chain, where a lot of the money, a lot of success were predicated on the food delivery, you know, the rise of the Deliveroo, the Uber Eats, and the Gustos and those guys. Mm. I think now we're living through what we call, and a lot of other people call now, the second generation, where a lot of the innovation is going into the products or into the manufacturing process. Christian was talking about cellular agriculture, the plant-based revolution, whether it is in meats or dairy or mushroom fermentations, you know, the way food can be made more scalable, better in terms of nutrition, lower in terms of impact on natural resources. I think this is where we're living through at the moment. And then there is some of the more kind of a next generation in terms of application of pure biotech, gene editing, and this type of technologies that are already being deployed. I think it's interesting because when people think of a trend, they think of a multiple data points, right, pointing to a certain direction. And of course, again, there is plenty of there. And the one that matters to us is how much capital is going into funding this industry. And it was triple, you know, a few years ago. And now we're talking about probably $4 billion this year being invested in Europe alone in this industry, right? So a million here, a billion there, we're talking money. Mm. And this is the kind of money that moves an ecosystem, that creates successes. And to me, when somebody asks me about a trend, it's always where you put the first dot, right? So, and to me, the first two dots of the real trend were the IPO of Beyond Meat and the recent IPO of Oatly, right? Those are the big macro events. So for me, those are the birth point of food tech as an industry from a capitalistic point of view, an entrepreneurial point of view, everything, scientific point of view, because is the moment where the poster children of this industry have been identified. And I go back to many years ago when I was a high-tech investor in software, and Europe had been challenged by the US market in terms of the scale of what Europe could produce. We didn't have big companies in Europe out of venture capital and the private equity early stage market until Skype happened. Skype was the first data point of a revolution where entrepreneurs and capital got excited and Europe can create this type of value for the whole people and parties around it. And I think when Beyond Meat and Oatly kind of went public recently, creating a huge amount of value for everybody involved, those are the two data points that I would put as the zero moment where the new Skype, right, for Europe and for the US, Beyond Meat, were identified. And I think from now on, bright students, bright entrepreneurs, hopefully bright investors and bright, you know, corporate officers are going to pay more and more attention to the disruption and value creation that food tech can create.
My third point or dot for you, Ivan, would be the acquisition of Danone of White Waves. So the fact that a huge dairy with so much history is buying an alternative, like shooting in their own leg. And so you would ask yourself, how come? You want to lose your dairy business? No, they saw the future. People might argue if they pay too much, not too much. But at the end of the day, this is a turning point. They joined the revolution. They joined the newcomers. They understood that the market is changing, driven by the consumer, to our latest point. So both Oatly, dear friends of ours, and Beyond Meat, amazing stories, put food tech on the front page, both of them driven by the consumers and the factors that we discussed before. But also, you see that the big CPGs understand that and they have to change and rapidly, even by paying a premium price for that. So for me, Danone White Waves, which is Alpro, as you know, was another point that I can add to Ivan's.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's a bit like a cigarette company moving into healthcare, which just cropped up in the news today. Now, we're going to take a bit of a global tour of certain areas that seem to be most exciting in terms of agritech. But first of all, Nadav, I wonder, are there sort of regional differences in terms of how advanced people are, in terms of areas of the world that seem to be grabbing hold of the ideas and the investment for agritech? And why is that? Is it about entrepreneurialism? Is it social or a cultural issue? Do you see this, these sort of strange drifts? And are there political impacts? Are there cultural impacts from this?
Sure. I don't know. For me, it's quite obvious. I think that if you should map where substance is, meaning where you have a combination of entrepreneurial spirit plus academia plus heritage, food industry, and then this is where you should focus. The obvious, you know, places would be, of course, West Coast, East Coast, US, UK, Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, Israel, and then going east, very fascinating. I think that we don't know much about India, but we have to start to pay attention to India. We have to feed, I mean, they have to feed a few people there. And then you can go, of course, further east, but I'm not sure that we understand well the east yet. And by the way, Pigbridge builds local funds to seed stage, and then we have our mothership that invests in later stages. So we have four funds now. And we believe that we have to focus at seed stage locally, where substance is. For example, it's still not very public, but our next jurisdiction will be actually East Coast. We think that what's happening in North Carolina Research Triangle is fascinating. And people are moving in the U.S. Look at Brian Betancourt moved there. Other people are moving to the Triangle. So a place that you would never suspect it. But there's so much academia, so much research and brains that it's not a new place to focus on. So find, map the ecosystem, and this is where you should focus.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start with somewhere that's a little bit, well, a strange start, really. The UAE. Now, United Arab Emirates is it's a very dry area. There's not a huge amount of arable land there, but they are investing heavily in an attempt to achieve some sort of food security. What are the big ideas coming from the UAE?
So I'll jump on this because actually my business partner lives in Dubai. He's a Swiss, but he lives in Dubai. So, and by the way, this is very exciting times for us because as an Israeli, the ability to travel to Dubai and the UAE is a kind of a revolution for us. I beg to differ about UAE's ambitions to create a food industry and research. I think that will take a long time. But one thing that we have to pay attention is that UAE's government decision of securing supply chain. And if I can add another dot, again, to Ivan's guidelines, look at how the UAE sovereign fund bought the majority of LDC, Louis Dreyfus. So a sovereign fund of a country invest in a trading company just to make sure, to some extent, that they can get supply. And this was not 2 cents, it was a few dollars. So I think that currently the idea of the UAE is A, to secure supply, secure food. I think that going from here to self-sustained, self-support is a long way. I mean, the starting point is not very promising. So it's really about technology, but it really has to be a breakthrough technology based on the geography, the climate, and the people. So for me, UAE is not very interesting. I apologize to be a party pooper here. It's not very interesting in finding the next technology, but it's very interesting in, and actually we are about to probably form a fund there because there is so much interest and there's so much people want to get on this wagon and to try stuff, but not from the technology point of view, but from being involved in something that has to do with technology.
So Christian, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? So if it's politics that is driving innovation, is that problematic in terms of a VC?
Well, I think first of all, it's very understandable if you look at a couple of data points, which give the UAE like the perfect storm ahead. Like it's importing 90% of its food. You have a very high urbanization rate. You have arid climate, which is really vulnerable looking at climate change. So it's very understandable that the government there pursues investments here, not just from a business opportunity point of view, but also actually from securing the supply chain. But I agree with Nadav here that I'm also fairly skeptical on the long-term success, at least if a couple of ingredients here are missing. And Nadav mentioned that academia is very important, and there are a couple of leading food tech universities and ag tech universities there. We have Wageningen in the Netherlands, we have Technion in Israel, and many others. But I don't think, or I haven't come across this yet there. And I think, so therefore, this part is lacking, and you can try to enforce this. And I think it's very reasonable. But so far, we have seen a couple of interesting companies there, but it hasn't developed to like a hotspot in contrast to other areas, which might be similarly small. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Ivan, would you agree that a lot of money suddenly moving into this area, mainly from the government potentially, does that make the UAE a good place to invest?
Is the UAE a good place to invest? I think it's a great source of capital. I mean, a lot of funds have investors from part of the UAE. And normally when you raise money from UAE investors, there is always an expectation that at some point you'll try to bring some technology company or create jobs or create something in the region. And I think the first generation of VC and investors figured out that it's not always as easy. So you need to kind of manage that expectation. There are certain businesses, though, that are perfectly suited for being developed into the UAE. I don't want to say that you're going to open up a research center over there or a development center over there. But if you are in vertical farming and you're looking at locations where the economics of difficult land, topsoil, cost of energy to be probably affordable, and extreme condition for logistics and everything else. I mean, that makes sense. And I think there is AeroFarm that is opening up there. So there are certain logics that work, and I don't think it's going to be forcing. It's just a matter of finding the right time and moment. There was a recent large investment in a company called Kitopi. This is one of those dark kitchen operators where you create food into places that are not restaurants for sitting down, but they're taking the food to you at home. You think it's coming from a restaurant, it's actually coming from a restaurant, but it's not a restaurant where you're meant to go and sit down with your wives or kids to have dinner. And this was a very, very large round. And if you think about it, this follows the trend where people, before and after pandemic, enjoy to have cooked meals taken to them at home. consumers are the same everywhere. You see the trends. There's no reason why, you know, it wouldn't work there. For 6 months a year, it's super hot, so you don't really want to go out anyway. So I think, you know, there is a propagation matrix for technology, right? As Nadav said at the beginning, first thing that comes to mind is Silicon Valley, right? There's the hot spot for a lot of things. I would still put Israel very, very close second for really true scientific innovation. And then the rest of the world with the Anglo-Saxon countries and then, you know, Southern Europe and then somewhere else. I think, you know, the UAE is just following that path with maybe a few months delay. But I think it's a pattern that we have seen before.
Yeah. Okay. Let's head east now and go to Singapore, another real trailblazer. I personally know a lot less about Singapore in terms of agritech. It's the first country to regulate lab-grown chicken meat to be sold. What's fascinating and exciting that's coming out of Singapore, Nadav?
Again, I think that it's, I would say that we can compare it to UAE and other places. You wouldn't find the next startup in Singapore, or at least at this stage, that will be able to compete with the brilliant, underappreciated, undervalued academia in Europe, or overappreciated, overvalued in the US. But I think that what is exciting about Singapore, which, by the way, is quite, UAE is a bit similar to Singapore in this sense, is that they're amazing investors. So if you look at the best in class and the top investor in the world for food tech and agtech is Temasek out of Singapore. So Singapore has huge interest and amazing investors backing food tech, but not necessarily in Singapore. So it's a hub for finance. It's not a hub for development and R&D. Mm-hmm. I would say that excluding two things. One is the heavy involvement of government that allows it to relatively do stuff creative and rapidly. So if the government decides, doesn't need to take it to parliament in the UK or the people's house on the hill. If they decide, they do it. Point. And the second thing that I might find interesting, and this is a huge potential for them, is of course aquaculture. And I think they have a lot about aquaculture, mm-hmm. including industry, research, and so forth, because they have so much water surrounding them.
That sounds quite exciting as well.
But don't look for the next technology out of the University of Singapore yet.
Yeah. Christian, would you agree? Are there some big ideas coming from Singapore? Is the food culture an influence on it?
Yeah, I'm very excited about Singapore. I have been a great fan of the country ever since I read a very interesting Harvard case study, actually, during my master's studies on the country. And it's really fascinating how the government, in the course of 40 to 50 years, really built it all up from the ground. And you can Google these images of Singapore 50 years ago and nowadays. It's incredible, and it seems quite sustainable what they're building on. In terms of actual technology, we really look closely at what's happening over there. We're not investing in Singapore. Sometimes I wish we could, because if you look, for example, at companies like Sophie's Bionutrients, which was founded by the founder who previously worked on Sophie's Kitchen on cultured fish, Sophie's Bionutrients actually developed the first milk based on microalgae. They also now developed the first burger patty based on microalgae. So it's very exciting, still very young companies. You have Sheok Meats also working on cultured fish. You have another company, Trax Retail, which I think has raised a couple hundreds of millions of dollars, which is working not on SELEC, but on inventory management for supermarkets. So again, I think given the size of the country, it's really incredible and seems to be one level ahead of the UAE, for example. And that is, of course, also due to the changes in regulation that we've seen there now, that it's possible to actually buy or consume cultured chicken meat there.
Oh, maybe a comment. I think I agree with the view that Singapore is an interesting place. We don't invest there, but we have looked at a few companies there in the last few years. I agree with Nadav. I think the quality of the capital infrastructure in Singapore is very high, with Temasek and governments of Singapore, you know, providing sustainable long-term capital that can have perhaps an advantage compared to maybe other system. It's there, and it's going to be there for a long, long time. If you couple that long-term view on innovation with the other part where, you know, already 10 years ago, the government of Singapore made incredibly attractive to set up IP-centric business in Singapore, where the IP is located and register in Singapore. So you get like tax breaks and so on and so forth. it becomes obvious, an obvious place to start biotech-centric companies, right? So you have long-term capital, you have incentive for IP-centric businesses. So companies like ShockMeek that Christian mentioned, I think Turtle Tree Labs is another company that is working. It's a small startup at the moment, but they're working on the development of synthetic breast milk for humans. Whereas, you know, there are deficiencies in all the Asian market for breast milk. It's one of the most interesting products where formula milk in China is sold behind the counter and is locked with security guards because it's the most stolen items in a supermarket, right? So you understand the emotional value on top of the, you know, financial value that innovation in IP-centric businesses in Asia can create. So we're seeing probably a slightly more indexation of IP-centric businesses based in that region.
If I can bring up an idea, and I think that maybe an idea how this should work, and I will use Christian's example of Trax Retail. So Trax Retail actually founded by two Israelis that lived 21 years in Singapore. So it started in Singapore. By the way, both of them wanted to go back, so they're both in Israel now. But R&D is in Israel. The company is Singaporean. And most of the management is in the US now. So Trax have 3 million stores in 90 countries that you have visibility to their shelves online. And imagine how you can manage a brand or a category with having visibility to 90 countries and 3 million stores online, licensed by AI. Could it happen in different set of jurisdictions? I don't know, but it worked. It started well in Singapore. And obviously, it's heading to the U.S., and most of the management is in the U.S. And by the way, I think that they're going public. So my point is that we can focus on different jurisdictions, but at the end of the day, I think that our job, all three of us, is to take and to find a local gem and then take it global.
Yeah.
This is how you can create, even to the extent of Oatly that Ivan mentioned before, it's a Swedish company, but it went public on that.
Yeah.
Couldn't happen such an IPO in Europe, I think.
Which makes a lot of sense. Although the place where ideas are born tends to have a combination of the right factors to seed those ideas to begin with. Now, I know you're itching to talk about Israel, Nedav. I can just feel it in my bones, but we're going to talk about the USA first. Now, USA is a place where AI and robotics and blockchain are all playing a part. What excites you about recent developments in the States? And are there still opportunities, you know, fresh ideas that are a bargain?
Well, actually, I like the U.S. tremendously. I spent at least a week, a month in the U.S. And I think that we're missing a bit the point here. So, of course, California is a lot about software and AI and so forth. But science in the U.S. is mind-blowing. If you look at MIT, Harvard, Boston, there's so much in the biotech and the pharma space, in of course, chemistry, in deep sciences, that you can drag and bring to food. And I think that it's even more interesting than a software or another delivery company. So US for me is very much fascinating in terms of the deep science of those domains rather than go and find the next software or AI company.
And Christian, any bargains to be had from the US?
Definitely agree. And I would just add that it's not just the technology and infrastructure that is great there, but it's also if you really just look at the consumer side, we see many companies that want to enter in the US first because you have a much larger market. Consumers have a much higher willingness to pay, at least compared to Central Europe. And they are also much more willing to experiment. And I think that's also reflected in the fact that I think in the US you have the second highest number of vegans if you just go by the absolute of numbers. Mm. I think in India, there's the highest number, and then in the US, the second highest number. And that also shows the level of experimentation and some trends we see. The cultural side of things even talked about Netflix having a great influence. Seeing this also personally, when I discuss food tech topics with my friends, there's Netflix documentaries. You have Seaspiracy, you have Cowspiracy. It's all driven by the US. And I think, therefore, it's basically the perfect ecosystem if there weren't sometimes some political issues. Mm. Otherwise, I think it basically has everything.
And Ivan, we're touching on a few other ideas which are beyond the capacity of the academia within a country. It is things like, is it a good testbed? Would you agree that that's really important, and certainly in terms of the US?
Innovations that succeed are innovations that are solving problems, right? Real problems. And when it comes to food, there are different problems in different parts of the world. And the fact that we're talking about the U.S. doesn't mean that it's oblivious of issues and challenges, right? I'll mention maybe a couple. And we don't invest in the U.S. I'm more of a tourist in the U.S., but you know, one of the things that I always love to do when I go to the U.S. is actually go to a supermarket, because I find it so fascinatingly different from what we have in Europe. Mm. And you have 200,000 SKUs in a supermarket. Can you imagine the complexity of managing the waste out of that? Incredible. Two other things. We go to New York and we think, okay, millions and millions of people live in here, but the food doesn't grow here. It has to come from somewhere else. Again, the logistic model to feed a city of that nature is mind-blowing. Mm. And then you take a plane and you go to, you know, anywhere else in the middle, right? Or Canada. And when you drive, you realize that the closest Costco or supermarket or Target is like 45 miles away. If you forgot your bread, you ain't going to go there and pick it up tonight. You are planning for replenishing your three-tier system. So you're fresh in the fridge, which is 1 week cycle. And then you have your massive freezer that is your buffer. And then you have your pantry for the dry food. The challenges are completely different, where distances and shelf stability have real different meaning in a, if you like, much easier European context, where we are solving for different problems on a different scale. So US is great for, because the extremes also appear. You have California, where, you know, there is an obsession with organic, locally sourced, and no pesticides. I was shocked when I walked into a Shake Shack the last time. I think maybe Nadav, you and I were at the same conference in San Francisco, and there was a Shake Shack next to the event, and I really wanted a burger. So I went in, and I saw the blackboard with the burgers in there, and I was really shocked by what was the adjective. The first word in front of the word burger was antibiotic free. So the American mindset is catching the attention of high-end people in a place like Shake Shack with antibiotic free meat. I've never seen anywhere else, right? Mm. So the list of concerns, the care about, the emotional attachment to what is the next big thing is really different there. And as I said before, normally trends start there and they move east on a, you know, 1 to 2 year cycle after that.
I think that's partly why I find it fascinating as well, the surprise elements that USA food throws at you.
But Stefan, just to build for a second about on Ivan, so yeah. Look at what a crazy nation it is. So it's a 320 or 30 million persons, so diverse, so different, such different culture, such different cuisines. And they go from one extreme to another. It's the country where Impossible and Beyond were invented, okay? On the other extreme, you have 50 million American citizens living in a food desert. As Ivan mentioned, they don't have a fresh lettuce or cucumber or tomato. Can you tell Ivan, a pure Italian, that he can't have his own tomato? He will commit suicide. So such a diversity from one to another. And then supply chain is fascinating. We are involved in a company that sells ice cream. I will not mention the name, but they have direct to consumer nationally in the US, with 50% of the sales is subscription. Can you imagine? You sit in your food desert and you get a supply of ice cream to your door. Insane.
And it sounds really complicated to get it there as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Let's
have a quick chat about Israel. We've got a whole episode about Israel and agritech, but I'm really interested in your views on it from a VC point of view. So Nadav, tell us about your thoughts about Israel.
Well, I started the first fund for food tech in Israel in 2014, so I truly have a perspective about the growth and the development that happened in this exciting part of the world. I say normally that for me, the right combination would have been an Israeli entrepreneur and a European science and American market. So I think that if you can have those three, you have a winner. I think that Israeli produces amazing entrepreneurs. Nothing to compare, and sorry for not being modest here, but I think that don't expect to have the next Impossible coming out of Israel. Mm-hmm. We don't know CPGs, we don't know brands. I think that science is relatively good, but again, I can't say that the Technion is better than the Louis Pasteur Institute in Paris. Sorry. or ETH or EPFL or TUM or Fraunhofer. No. But to take the great ideas and to start startups, I think that Israel is a great hub. And I think that Israelis should be modest and understand that they have a limit to where they can take it. And then they have to collaborate with other people from other places. The one thing which I think about the Israeli culture is that if I can compare cultures, so if you look at a French entrepreneur, so normally he will start in the area when he starts. So let's say Lyon, then he sells locally, and then he goes to entire France, and then he goes to countries speaking French and so forth. The Israeli entrepreneur typically will open a company, and the next day he will buy a ticket to New York. From day one, they will think global. They will think, what can I do substantial globally, have an effect? So this is why I think that it's, again, the combination or hybrid of cultures is important. Also, I think that Israel eventually has to focus. You can't do everything and excel in everything. So I think that Israel is pretty good at, historically, of course, agriculture, but we are food people, not agriculture, but agriculture, because of needs, we had to develop the irrigation system. So, you know, all those stories and so forth. But when it comes to food, I think that Israel could be quite advanced and leading in the biotech intersection with food, because we have relatively great science there, and also software. And this is something that is really lacking in the food tech scene. So food industry in general is not using a lot of data. The more we can bring data to the food industry, the better. So for me, Israel should focus on biotech, meats and dairy and smart things, and also software and food, but neglect or not focus on the stuff. We can't compete with big brands, with markets that can test products. But to start a company in Israel and then move it to Europe and US, I think this is the right combination.
Okay, Christian, what's your view on this? Again, I've been to Israel. There's a lot of rocks and it's quite pretty dry. So same sort of geography elements, I guess, as we were discussing with the UAE. But still exciting for you?
Yeah, I think I don't have much to add to what Nadav has said, because we're quite often blown away by the quality of innovation that we see from Israel, especially given the size of the country. You're really wondering what they're doing, that they are so damn entrepreneurial. And you would wish that in Germany, I think, where we also have very good science and academia, maybe less on the food sides of things, but in general, but there's definitely not that much innovation per capita. So I'm just always at awe looking at Israel, especially in the food tech space. Yeah. Mm.
So Ivan, I'd love to know what your thoughts are about Africa. I mean, it's a very food insecure region, it's a net importer of food, but vast area, a lot of it incredibly fertile. Are there African agritech scenes which are offering great solutions to particular problems?
I give you a short answer, and I think it's a no. Based on the only thing that we have real visibility on, which is deal flow. So we receive 60, 70, or we originate, not just receive, we originate 60, 70 opportunities every month. And I would say, I was just looking in my CRM system, and I would say less than 2% of those opportunities have something to do with Africa. I think more of the larger scale project that we are aware of, not something we can invest in, is more infrastructure. If you really want to have impact in Western Europe or North America, you reduce sugar, plastic, and you reduce saturated fat and salt. If you want to have real impact in Africa, you build a street to connect the port of Dakar to a food processing facility where ice is available. I think that's not the job of VCs. I think that's the job of, you know, the Monetary Fund or some of the international large infrastructure funds. But, you know, it's not yet, I think, where we can make a difference. We are at individual level, we're all small funds. Even at aggregate level, we're still relatively small. If you want to have real impact on sustainability and farmers' welfare, I think it's not something that we can really make a difference yet.
That's very much my experience of Africa. It's, what they really need is roads. They need silos. They need warehousing. They need infrastructure. And then on top of that, you can overlay entrepreneurialism.
Yeah, we've seen tons and tons of Red Snapper, you know, going bad off the port of Dakar just because there was no ice. I mean, that is what infuriates people, right? That's where I think some other smarter, bigger investors than we are should dedicate capital and talent to fix those problems.
I would add, though, that this also offers a chance in terms of actually leapfrogging maybe some legacy systems which haven't really worked properly. So, for example, if you have very old legacy systems in farming or using outdated tools, maybe in the second stage of things. But for example, in agritech, farmers, they come go maybe straight from the first phase to the third phase, maybe looking at cell, like, for example, I know it sounds a little bit futuristic right now, but I think that might be an interesting chance where it actually increases the overall effectiveness if you don't have to deal with some legacy problems. That would be the opportunity that you might see here. But I agree with Ivan that it's not that visible yet, at least also in terms of actually startups that we're seeing in that space.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic to be thrown into, I guess. Now, I've got one last question I'm going to ask each of you, and that's just about what one exciting project or product has turned your head. What are you excited about that's coming up? Something, some ideas, and maybe some people, maybe a particular area that you're interested in now, which you weren't interested in a couple of years before. What's the exciting bit, Nedav, for you that's coming up?
We can talk about portfolio companies. I think that has to be a new rule that we're making up against you, Stefan. I think you know, we can talk about one portfolio company.
So I had a coffee today with my dear friend, Anat Binur, founder and CEO of UKO, UKKO, PhD MIT, was a managing partner at Innovation Endeavors, went back to Israel and started UKO. UKO found the epitode, the tiny atomic particle of the proteins that activates your immune system to what you call allergy. So if God's will, one day we're going to do this recording face to face, and we're going to have a great croissant or bread or pasta. And if God's forbid I have celiac, then I will go to ER and you guys will party. What's the difference? It's the same bread. The difference is that something in the structure of the gluten binds to my blood and it doesn't to yours. By using amazing AI, they have the largest bank samples of blood with allergies today in the world. They analyze the structure of the proteins, and by using recombinant yeast, they build a gluten which is 99.9999% gluten, identical to what we consume, but will be safe for people with celiac, same for nuts and dairy and so on. So for me, this is exciting. If God's will, we're going to do an amazing multiple, but it's not really about the return exclusively. It's about, as Ivan said, it's a huge problem, allergies in the world. Is a huge problem. Mm. And those guys might have the solution to consume the real stuff, the natural stuff. I hate gluten-free. It's processed food, costs four times more. But having the real thing, the original thing, which will be safe only by the ability to use a lot of biotech, deep science, I think this is fascinating. So the intersection between science, deep science, and food, it's amazing to me.
Yeah, exciting and could be life-changing on a global scale, which is really interesting. Christian, what's barreling down the tunnel towards you? What's the exciting stuff for the near future?
It's probably not a very surprising answer, but I think the holy grail that's currently out there in the food tech industry is still cultured meat. And I myself have a business background, which makes it even more exciting for me to talk with these amazing scientists. And I think the most interesting startups we're going to see here are the ones that are using computational tools from other areas, software, maybe biosensors on really making, on bringing cultured meat to the next level, where it's currently not. And I think if maybe in, it's always the famous 2050, how do we feed 10 billion people by then? And I think just plant-based is not going to cut it. There are many, many downsides also to just plant-based alternatives. So I think this is really the one technology that I want to see succeed. And if we see here maybe B2B startups working in that area, please reach out to me. We're very excited about that at Atlantic Food Labs.
It's a really exciting area, isn't it? And it feels as though something is about to just come over the top and explode and become really exciting. Ivan, what's exciting for you in the near future?
So when we talk about food tech, and we're predominantly a consumer food tech investor, right? So we we rather stay on that part of the supply chain. The excitement is that food tech has the opportunity to solve at the same time two of the biggest challenges of the next generation, climate change and human health, right? If you wake up in the morning and you think, I'm going to find a company that can fix both things at the same time or contribute, I think you're going to feel pretty good about that. Now, 2.5 years ago, we found a company that tried to make people drink more water, just plain water, without adding anything to it. We passed 3 times on that company. Finally, 3 times later, we invested in a company that is turning out to be one of the most exciting I've ever seen in my 20-year career as an investor. The company is called AirUp. It's a German company based in Berlin. And they designed a plastic bottle that you can use many, many, many times, fill it up with tap water, or if you are in the US, one of the water fountains or the coolers that you have there. And there is a cap, which is a pod that contains flavor for your nose to smell. So the system fools your brain by drinking normal water, and it fools your brain, making you think that you're drinking flavored water. Nothing goes into the water, nothing goes into your system. Just like when you eat cheese, you smell the cheese before you eat it. And if you have a cold, food doesn't have as much flavor. That's because, you know, 60% of your flavor is actually perceived through your retronasal system. So these guys have invented a solution that allows people not to be dehydrated. We are constantly dehydrated, especially in offices. We don't drink water. Water is boring. People don't want to drink water. And then you end up drinking fizzy drinks or sugary drinks and ingesting all sorts of things that you shouldn't. And at the same time, you know, you have to carry those water bottles or sodas bottles from somewhere to your office with a negative impact on carbon emission. And then that single-use plastic is going to be found everywhere on the documentary of Netflix. So imagine, you know, we're super excited and this company is going incredibly well. It's the fastest growing company I've ever had in my portfolio in 25 years of being an investor. And, you know, it's really like solving a problem of dehydration, taking away sugar or any chemicals from what you drink, removing plastic bottles and avoiding the transportation of bottles with gallons and gallons of water from A to B. I mean, it cannot get any better, really. I mean, that is really super exciting to me.
And I like the fact that it's really innovative and really pushes things a lot further. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. I mean, some of these ideas are so exciting and could genuinely change the world. I'm excited about the future and the potential that agritech has for solving some of the huge problems facing the world. So thank you very much for talking. You've been listening to Christian Guber, Ivan Fanetti and Nadav Berger. Thank you so much, all of you, for talking to me today. There's a whole new world out there to explore with this, and I hope that we'll talk again about this in the very near future. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry. Some of my recent favourites have been our look at the science behind fuller for longer food and chrononutrition, how our nutrition is impacted by the time at which we eat. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. And thank you so much for listening.